and gentlemen, please take your seats. Ladies and gentlemen, please take your seats. Thank you.
So we're going to get started with Q&A. And what we've done, as you know, is you've submitted questions. There have been a number of them. So I went through them and grouped them into areas of focus. And I'm going to start with the questions around the beverage distribution system. There were a good number of questions regarding whether or not there are conflicts with Coke and Pepsi dropping our brands. And I'm going to ask Jim to answer that one.
Yeah, absolutely not. Dr. Pepper, you look at the chart up on the screen, is the lion's share in the Coke and Pepsi system of what they sell is Dr. Pepper. There is no competing legitimate brand in either system, notwithstanding Mr. Pibb, competing with Dr. Pepper in this category. It's absolutely a viable brand. We're not in danger of losing it in any route to market, let alone Coke or Pepsi systems. The other brands that we sell in our company-owned and independent distributors are fully franchised there. We compete against some of Coke and Pepsi's brands in those systems, but Dr. Pepper in the cola systems is rock solid. There's no brand like it, and it's not getting it dropped by anyone.
Okay, so another question in that same area is on Pete's. The question is, how is Pete's going to get distribution through the cola systems given competing brands? And I'm going to ask Larry to answer that one.
Yeah, well, it would not be going through the cola system. If you look at our distribution slide up here, we have number three and number four, the company-owned and the independent distributors. That covers 100% of the United States. That's where we'd run the Pete's coffee. Coke has their coffees, Pepsi has coffee, so we'll be doing just like the rest of the market. We'll be competing against each other, but we would do 100% in our company-owned and our independent distributors.
Thanks, Larry. Okay, the next question is, how important is Dr. Pepper Snapple's distribution to Keurig Green Mountain's growth? I'm going to ask Bob to take that one.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, this system that we just talked you just saw in the previous slide is a huge element of the platform that we're building. So to be able to reach every retail outlet as part of the vision that we talked about before, you need the scale of the brands that are in the DPS portfolio and this distribution network that covers almost every single point of distribution through the five mechanisms that are talked about in there. So, I mean, that's a huge part of the attraction of this acquisition. The other part, too, is the scalability of the DSD piece of it and how hard it is to get distribution in convenience stores. So take a look at this chart here, which is the one that I really like. It shows you it is a tremendous challenge to be able to get widespread convenience store distribution, which single outlet, a small outlet, single bottle purchases is really where all of these brands are born and built. It's the hardest thing to do to be able to get this level of distribution. And so I think that these are great examples of what we're really interested in. This is the scalable nature of the acquisition. Now, I'm a little unclear on the question that was said. You said it was on KGM's goals. It's KGM's attraction of doing this deal. The goals that we have in terms of the standalone growth, don't account for this at all. I mean, we were able to achieve those growth goals that we showed out there regardless of this, based on the three ways that we get the market that Patrick showed you. So we see this as really, you know, the bigger platform play and some incremental opportunities, as we talked about with some of the close-in launches that we showed you on one of those slides.
Got it. Okay, so let's turn to pricing. There are a number of questions there as well. Question around what the risk is that pricing on pods continues to fall, requiring us to lower pricing further. And then similarly, there was a question on the risk that premium players like Starbucks continue to lower their pod pricing. I'm going to ask Bob.
Do you want me to do both
yeah,
those slides?
Do both of those.
There you go. I was going to ask for that chart. There you go. Perfect. Look, I think we showed this chart really to give you a feel of what the pricing thresholds are from a consumer perspective. And when I look at the structure of premium, mainstream, and private label and the gaps between them, this is textbook for what you see in most categories in CPG. And it also shows really rational behavior. It tells you that there's a consumer who's really interested in entry-level price points and value, and they're the ones who gravitate towards private label. It tells you that there's a mainstream branded segment, and the mainstream brands that we have in here, and it's in the, I think it's in the footnote, but it's Maxwell House, Folgers, and Green Mountain. And Donut Shop would be in there as well. And then you've got premium brands, Pete's, Starbucks, Dunkin' Donuts are in there. So the relationship that you're seeing is very much intact. Pricing is going down. Now, we've helped contribute to that pricing because we've taken our productivity savings and we've shared it with our partners. They've reflected that to consumers, which is rational behavior. And it's a big driver of what's stimulating household penetration. Because as Ozan showed you when we got here in 2016, the statistic that's right in your face is that the number one barrier to people coming in the system is the price of pods. And there's been a lot of stuff that's been written out there when you benchmark the pricing of pods in the U.S. to Europe, where household penetration is much higher, is that the premium in the U.S. was way too high. And I would argue that was enabled by a system that had IP protection and a relatively inefficient supply chain, passing on the inefficiencies to the consumer. So we're taking productivity, we're sharing it with our partners, we're lowering the price to the consumer, but you saw our margins that we're able to protect while we're doing this. And it becomes the biggest driver of household penetration growth. And when you see this chart, based on the pricing studies that we've done, we're hitting levels where it becomes very reasonable from a consumer standpoint. So when you say at 30 cents, over 75% of consumers find that price to be a bargain. That's as low as you need to go. Where you're getting to that level for the highly price-sensitive consumer for private label. And when you hit 50%, the great majority of consumers don't see that as expensive. Well, that's the right price point for a mainstream brand. And the question about Starbucks is a premium brand, as is Pete's and Dunkin' Donuts. It should be priced well above mainstream. That's what it's all about. The other thing I would point out is Starbucks, Pete, and Dunkin' Donuts are growing share of the system. So people are willing to step up. And I again, as the owners of the system, we want everybody in the system. We want all partners in the system, including private label players. We want to offer a price point where somebody who is apprehensive of getting in the system comes in, and that's around, you're close to it at 34 cents. And then it's our job as marketers to trade people up to higher quality, higher price point items. It's like that in every single category. I think it'll be exactly the same here. And the reason we share that with you is to suggest that our belief is that the pricing doesn't go down indefinitely. Now, the one thing I would point out, it was in Ozan's outlook slides. We didn't say in the outlook that we think pricing is done. We said it moderates. So I think we're taking a conservative posture and saying we've modeled in our business that we're going to continue to give price concessions for a period of time. This just gives you some sense of how we think about how long that period of time is. Right there. We don't talk about what the production cost is of that.
All right, let me get
next
to
try
the
though.
All right, getting to the next area of questions. Really, it surrounds mix.
Yes.
All right, so I know the question is, how have pod economics for owned versus partner/licensed brands evolved since acquisition? And I'm going to ask Ozan to take this one.
Sure, thank you. First of all, We are not a traditional, as Keurig standalone, we are not a traditional CPG company from a profit-making perspective. We always need to consider that we have an ecosystem, and that ecosystem comes in three pieces. One is the whole brewer economics. The other one is owned and licensed brands, and the third one would be partners and the private label. Let's put them in one bundle. Clearly, because we own the brands, we do generate a higher penny profit per pot behind the owned and licensed brands. We should, because we invest behind our owned and licensed brands as well at the same time. But however, we are also quite pleased with our current profitability, and as Bob said, the projected profitability in the upcoming 3 to 4 years, all behind both owned and licensed as well as our partner group. There's one thing to note. Please make sure that we have been talking, as we guided and went public in our proxy statements, we have managed to successfully improve our gross profit as well as gross margin. We have been talking operating income and EBITDA, but please don't forget the gross margin, basically sales minus cost, which all this pricing, all the cost outs and so forth that happens to get together, right? So we improved at 600 to 700 basis points. While we did all these price, strategic price alignments, the private label price, partner price concessions, and so forth and so forth. Why? Again, we manage the ecosystem of our profitability, and we do care a lot, big time, our gross margin, as well as the gross profit. And given that we are investing behind our own 10 license, at the operating income level, the gap gets narrower between our owned and licensed versus the partner private label group that we generate profitability. That's why it's not that straightforward, and it's not clearly a typical CPG company that we are actually or we have been managing. What matters is the ecosystem profitability, and please make sure that the same margin expansion that has happened at the EBITDA level did happen at the gross margin level, because we did this in a very systematic, around a very tight algorithm just to take the company to the next level.
Thank you, Ozan. Another one similarly about mix / market share is, how should we think about market share for Keurig-owned brands? Bob, you want to take that one?
Yeah, I'll take it. So if you go back to the beginning of time of the Keurig system, the Keurig-owned brands were 100% share. By the way, that was where all the other competitive systems were. You looked at Tassimo, the original Senseo, Starbucks, Verismo, et cetera. They all had their own brands in there. So the good news is they had a system and 100% owned brands. The bad news is they never got any traction, because what the consumer wants is full brand choice in the system. So when Keurig made the appropriate strategic decision to open the system up to competitive brands, that's what made it far and away the market leader in this country, and the other ones did not get traction because people want one system with multiple brands. So by definition, the day that decision was made, Green Mountain and other owned brands were going to continue to lose share, and that's exactly what's happened. But while that was happening, the category growth, the system growth was up significantly. So what you saw for a number of years was a significant step down in owned and licensed growth, but actual volume growth of owned and licensed pods was still increasing, and nobody had an issue with that. What happened in the time period of around 15-16 is the market share loss slowed down, but the growth in the system slowed at the same time, and for the first time you saw pod volume decline. So my point on this one is, share is not the right metric always. In this case, it's really, are you able to grow pods, because it's a combination of share and the system growth. So as we accelerate system growth, which you're seeing happening right now, everybody within the system is worried less about share. They're much more in the situation where they can see growth. They're also worried less about pricing when they see the system growing again. So a lot of the behavior on pricing and share focus was driven by the fact that the system slowed down and nothing else. The other thing I would point out is, over the years, additional brands were added into the system, which means that there's going to be pressure. So Dunkin' Donuts, for example, was one of the last brands to enter the system. By definition, somebody's going to lose share as a result of that. As we sit here today, we're approaching a point of equilibrium. We show you this pricing chart so you can kind of see how we think pricing is working out. Essentially, every brand that can be in the system is now in the system, so there's no big disruption coming in like another Dunkin' Donuts coming into the system. Our owned and licensed brands are about a 30 share, and we'd like to keep them around that level. And if you look at the share on owned and licensed, as we put marketing behind it, like we showed you on Green Mountain, we're now putting it in for Donut Shop. That doesn't start until May. We're just putting marketing out there on brands like Laughing Man. We've seen that that share loss has moderated. It's actually growing on the Green Mountain brand, but it's moderated, and we think it's going to stabilize somewhere around where it is right now. And I know in talking with some of you that had very intricate Keurig models, that you always were trying to model the difference between profitability of an owned and licensed brand, a partner brand, a private label brand, and then we're really focused on mix because mix was changing so much. As I said to a number of you, I think you can take some pressure off yourself right now, because if you look, it's an impossible task. And the reason you can take some pressure off yourself is we've created a lot of pricing. I would say we have rational pricing right now. As we become more partly friendly, the discrepancies in pricing have largely gone away. We have a rational pricing structure that we offer our partners because we don't want our partners to think that one is getting a big advantage or disadvantage versus the other. And the mix that you see in the system right now between private label, partner brands, and owned and licensed is pretty stable right now. So you can just look at the average profitability per pod and use that as more of the thought process of the Keurig business versus trying to really get into profit by brand, because I think the mix that we're talking about right now, including owned and licensed, is relatively stable.
Great, thank you. Okay, let's turn our attention to synergies and integration. Some questions regarding our ability to achieve the $600 million in synergies. And I know that, you know, some folks have had that question. I've spoken to you about that. Can you provide some perspective on that for us, Ozan?
Sure. My favorite topic. Most favorite. So first of all, a couple of points that I like to bring further color. Number one, there is 120 pages of detailed. And this is these are Excel spreadsheets, not colorful marketing charts, with no offense.
There's nothing wrong with behind colorful marketing charts.
No problem with that either. I'm no problem. Just saying.
No offense.
So just saying, 120 pages of very detailed study behind the $600 million. Please rest assured. And not only we have that, we brought McKinsey and Ernst & Young, M&A teams, just to pressure test our findings, not assumptions, our findings. Both of them came back and said, in fact, we should dial up the number, but we didn't. Second point, $600 million is only cost synergies. There is no revenue synergy or top-line synergy or RGM opportunities that we have included because we wanted to be a little bit on the conservative side. Therefore, $600 million, again, is the number that we have built in our future outlook that does not include any revenue synergies, and we all know, as we have taken you through and you have seen on the interactive session, that there will be revenue synergies. So this is the second point. The third data point, when we say deal synergies, we really mean it. So what we mean? What we mean is we are not relying on or expecting to receive standalone synergies that may be possible at DPS, balance sheet or profit and loss, in order to make that number. This is a very important point as well. Why? Because we have a great visibility. When we put the two companies together, the initiatives and the structural improvements that we are going to implement are strictly related due to bringing two companies together. There is actually $0 that we have included, for example, as I have taken you through before. When you look to manufacturing, standalone DPS, we put zero because it's nothing to do with the deal synergies. DPS can get low synergies if they want to. Therefore, we were extremely careful when we put together that $600 million, as I have explained and as I am explaining to you. Therefore, These assumptions are very important and the facts to figure this out, how we approach to the overall deal synergies. We have been talking about the profit and loss synergies or cost synergies. Let's talk for a minute, 30 seconds, on the cash synergies. Please remember, in 20 months at Keurig, we managed to find 3,300 basis points of improvement of our sales in working capital, which is an incremental cash that has been available due to the EBITDA delivery. This is incremental. And I'm sure you can do the math. Math is there, $1.2 billion of incremental cash that we managed to deliver in Keurig in the last 21 months on top of the normal EBITDA-driven cash flow generation. There is no reason why those numbers will not be applicable for DPS when we apply the same book. And there is no inhibitor, nothing, in front of us that we cannot take copy and paste over to the DPS, and my fellow CFO, Marty Allen, agrees with our numbers anyway when we sit around the table and explain how and what we are planning to do. Therefore, besides the profit and loss synergies, there's a great play in town in the whole working capital and incremental cash generation as well. That's why we feel very good about when we said following the closure of the deal in 2 to 3 years, our leverage multiple will be free, if not below. So these were the 4 points that I wanted to share with you, being very open and transparent. Thank you.
Thanks, Ozan. Okay, let's turn our attention to a different question, different area. What are we doing to influence morale and flight risk at DPS?
Okay, I'll take that one. So Derek came up here and gave you the game plan for how we think about integration. And this will be my 12th acquisition integration. So you get experience in doing this. I always look at it in this order. Do no harm, first of all. Make sure you have a seamless day one startup, which means that all the key players in place, they know how to do their job, and they know where to report and where to get a decision made. Secure the synergies, then go after revenue growth opportunities. That's why we haven't modeled any revenue growth opportunities in there, because that's the priority. They also have much more control over the first steps than you do over the revenue growth side. So I personally never put those in any acquisition plan because it's the hardest thing to control. Doesn't mean it stops us from putting programs in place to drive revenue, as we talked about, or you saw some examples earlier today. But the very first couple of steps, and this team is going to have to go in, is who are the key players, where do they stand, where's their mindset, how do we incentivize the right people to stay? And that's really job one. So we've got a couple of months between now and the close. As Derek said, the integration team is up and running in Plano as of tomorrow. And so then I start traveling back and forth on a regular basis. And where these conversations start before we get into all of the synergy conversations and revenue conversations starts with people. Who are the key people? Who's motivated? Who wants to stay? Who doesn't want to stay? How do we fill the gaps? Because in the end, it's always about getting the right people in place to drive the strategy and deliver the results, and then make sure that you can build on the cultures of both companies to create something even better. That to me is 101 on acquisition integration.
Thanks, Bob. Okay, so I think we're at the last question,
Good timing, yeah.
There were a number of questions on M&A opportunities and international expansion. So without going into the word-by-word questions, just what's your thought on both of those opportunities for the company?
You want me to do that?
Yes, please.
International is not on the radar screen at all right now, other than the international markets in which we're already in. We have a $160 billion business in the U.S. with a lot of upside to it. The brands don't necessarily travel, and distribution, which is a key part of this, definitely doesn't travel across borders. So you don't get any benefit from doing that. So we want to be able to leverage the infrastructure that we're building in the U.S. across more scale, which means plugging more brands in it and renovating and innovating on the existing brands that we have. So to me, that's the big priority. M&A is clearly part of the picture. We're not going to talk about any specifics on that. But again, that's why the cash flow piece of this becomes really important, because you want to be able to pay down your debt very quickly so that you have options for acquisitions. And as I talked about on the original launch date, I think the game plan that these guys have put in place where you can buy something outright, you can do partnerships with them at multiple levels involving minority equity ownership or a partnership makes a ton of sense. You see what we're doing, you know, the example, small example back there, but a real significant one for the future, which is Forto. know, that's a minority investment that we put in there. And you've got Neil and that team out there tapping into the resources that we have, but they're out there driving that business day in and day out. And they're real entrepreneurs, and they're getting things done. I like that model because I like it when somebody else outside of the company is still driving for aggressive growth and is incentivized to do that. That to me is a real win-win. So I think we can play across all elements of partnership, distribution, and M&A, but it's our priority right now is to get the business that we just talked about in place seamlessly, stay focused in North America, and then we'll layer in other brands where the opportunity presents itself. And the shortest term thing we can do is get the cash flow so that we have the option to do it.
Thank you, Bob.
Okay.
I think that's it. Amazingly, we have 1 minute left, so I'm going to thank everyone for coming.
Great.
It's been a pleasure to host you here today at headquarters. What I want to just let everyone know is we have prepared box lunches for you to take with you, so please, on your way out when you leave, to the left on the left-hand side, we have lunches for you to take to the airport or wherever it is you're going. I know a storm is coming, as Bob mentioned earlier. We're probably all heading into it. So we wanted to get you off on time so that you didn't miss any flights. Hopefully they're not canceled on you. Thanks again for coming.
Travel safe.